Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Melissa Benmark, and for Mark Bayshore, I'm the other MB. As always, an interesting show today, and before we get into it, really news of a historical nature just coming down in the last few minutes. The Dean of the House, U.S. Representative John Dingell, has announced he will not be running again. He first ran in and started serving in 1955. He's been in the U.S. House 58 years. He was 29 when he first got the seat, and there is some speculation that his wife, Debbie Dingell, will run for his seat. But truly, he's been around for as long as I and many people can remember, so this is definitely a change in era coming down. Well, we will end up in Vegas eventually on our program today, but today we're starting out in court, the Supreme Court. Actually, the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today that will help determine the scope of what kinds of emissions the Environmental Protection Agency can regulate. The outcome of this could have a substantial effect on industrial facilities nationwide. Dr. Noga Morag-Levine is a professor of law at MSU's College of Law. She sat down with Current State's Mark Bayshore a couple of days ago to explain the issue and why it's important. And Mark first asked what the central legal issues were in the case.
So the rule, as you mentioned, will restrict emissions from stationary sources, by which we're referring to industrial facilities such as refineries, chemical plants, cement plants, and will require them to control their greenhouse gas emissions through best available technology as part of any expansion or upgrading process. The EPA claims that it is authorized to issue such a rule under the Clean Air Act, indeed that it is compelled to do so as a consequence of its regulation of greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. The petitioners, which include a large group of states, among them Michigan, in fact, contend that the EPA does not have the authority to put such a rule in place under the Clean Air Act. And the legal question really boils down to a matter of statutory interpretation with respect to the authority of the agency, of the EPA, under the Clean Air Act.
And a few fairly recent rulings are relevant to this issue as well. Tell us briefly about those.
The history of this debate dates back to the Supreme Court's 2007 decision in Massachusetts versus EPA, where the court ruled that the EPA was authorized to regulate greenhouse gases as pollutants under the Clean Air Act, and indeed that it was obligated to do so if it finds that these gases endangered public health. In 2009, the EPA made two findings that are related to the case that is being discussed today. The first, known as the endangerment finding, concluded that current and projected levels of six specific greenhouse gases threatened the health and welfare of current and future generations. The second concluded that in the aggregate, greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles increased the threat of climate change.
And those led to what?
On the basis of both of these findings, the EPA issued in 2010 a tailpipe rule establishing greenhouse gas standards for cars and light trucks. Mm-hmm. Later that year, that is 2010, the EPA determined that its authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from mobile sources and the rule that I just mentioned triggered its authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from stationary sources under a different section of the Act. The EPA was basing this on a long-standing policy that existed in the agency dating to the early 1980s, which pertained to air pollution in general, not global warming in particular.
Why would whether a source moves or not make any difference in terms of the enforcement of emissions?
The issue here is not the identity of the source as a mobile source versus a stationary source. The initial question was that the EPA made a finding, as I mentioned a moment ago, that greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles in the aggregate endanger public health. That was step one. Step two was a promulgation of the rule, the tailpipe rule, that said because we made the endangerment finding with respect to emissions from cars, we're going to make a rule restricting those emissions. So the first step is a step about the regulation of emissions from cars based on the EPA's authority. The controversial question in this case is the next move, because the EPA, relying on the policy that I just mentioned, interprets the Clean Air Act under a different section of the law, that once it is regulating a pollutant, in this case greenhouse gases, under one section of the law, its authority to regulate under the permitting sections of the other section is triggered. There is interconnection, a statutory interconnection within the law. So this is not a matter of the logic of regulating cars versus stationary sources, but whether or not the statutory authority exists.
It's really a legalistic dispute.
I would say so, very much. Yes.
What's driving the stakeholders in this case? What does each side want?
Well, the petitioners would like the rule invalidated on the ground that the EPA exceeded its authority. There are concerns regarding the costs of implementing the rule on the part of various stakeholders. And there are, I think, concerns on their part that if it is upheld, the EPA would extend its current program with respect to greenhouse gases even more broadly than the current rule is implemented. On the other hand, the EPA, as well as many states who support the EPA and, in fact, filed supporting briefs to the EPA's policy in this respect, believe that the regulation is feasible and that they support the EPA's regulation in this respect and would like this to go forward.
We're talking with Professor of Law Noga Marag-Levine of the Michigan State University School of Law about today's Supreme Court session involving EPA rules restricting greenhouse gas emissions from stationary sources. If the court finds that the EPA can regulate stationary sources, how does that affect power plants, factories, the fixed sources?
Well, what it would mean is that in the course, under this particular rule, in the course of any kind of upgrading, that a major facility that is covered by the rule, and the rule as it is currently written is restricted to particularly large facilities, would have to control their emissions through the use of best available technology.
Technology, okay. Some court case decisions seem predictable, others less so. What do you think might happen in this case, and why?
Well, I would hardly hazard a prediction, maybe besides the thought that it is quite likely that it would be a sharply divided court, as decisions of this type have tended to be in the past. The key issue that is going to be before the court is whether or not the justices will decide to defer to the agency with respect to its interpretation of the statute, or whether they decide not to. And you're asking before about what was at stake in this, and I would say that beyond the immediate question of the regulation of stationary sources, there's really the larger issue of the ability of the EPA in the face of congressional stalemate on this issue to use administrative executive action to regulate greenhouse gases. If the court upholds it, this is a great political boost to the agency. If it doesn't, it would be a politically problematic loss.
We want to thank Noga Marag-Levine, who's a professor of law at Michigan State University, for helping us understand today's hearing at the U.S. Supreme Court involving the EPA. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And for Current State, I'm Mark Bayshore.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. While today the city of Detroit is working to overcome its financial troubles, some see a bright future for the city, especially because of Detroit's location. Current State's Emmanuel Berry joins me in the studio to explain why Detroit's geography could play a significant role in the city's recovery. Hey.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. So what many people overlook about Detroit is its close proximity to water, but not just any water. We're talking fresh water, water which will become more important as climate continues to shift across the United States. I spoke with Francis Grunow, a partner at New Solutions Group, who recently penned a series for Model D focusing on geography and urban planning. In his latest article, Grunow explains Detroit's relationship to water and its location within the Great Lakes megaregion. What's a megaregion? Grunow explains.
There was this really interesting thing that I saw by the Regional Plan Association a few weeks ago when I was writing this piece that basically posited the idea that, you know, we should shift our thinking to not so much even metropolitan regions, but these mega regions, because they really are the ways that we do business on a larger system, these economic systems that share natural resources and ecosystems and transportation systems and infrastructure. And it kind of got me thinking about, you know, how Detroit fits in, you know, not only to the region, but this mega region. And so Detroit is part of the Great Lakes mega region, which basically goes into Canada and goes around Chicago and even further to Minneapolis, and then the south as far as St. Louis, including places like Cincinnati and Pittsburgh. So these are really the areas and the ways that we could be thinking about large decision-making and planning ideas going forward, you know, decades forward. So it was an interesting sort of exercise, and Detroit is a very important part of the Great Lakes mega region.
Why is Detroit significant to this mega region besides the fact of its central-esque location? What other aspects of it make it an important factor?
Well, yeah, so first of all, right, you mentioned its sort of centrality in the Great Lakes. It's also in the middle of the Great Lakes watershed. So the Great Lakes mega region shares several watersheds, but the Great Lakes themselves, Detroit is smack dab in the middle of that as well. A lot of people don't realize that even though a place like Chicago sits right on Lake Michigan, it's only partially in the Great Lakes watershed. In fact, the reason that the river had to be reversed is that it empties into Lake Michigan. You know, everybody talks about how Chicago did this incredible civil engineering feat by reversing the flow, but it meant that the water goes into Lake Michigan from a higher point. So Chicago's kind of perched on the edge of the Great Lakes. Michigan sits in the middle of the Great Lakes and has access to points of water from throughout. Additionally, where Detroit sort of sees itself right now in its history is interesting. You know, it's in the middle of this really gut-wrenching bankruptcy proceeding, and it suffered from disinvestment for decades. And I think a lot of people see that as a negative, but if you look at Detroit in the context of a much longer time frame, you know, cities rise and fall, and they go through these different iterations. And I think the upside of all of that is that through reorganization and through some tough times, Detroit still has an incredible amount of infrastructure. It also has land, and we've identified that as the worldwide population will grow over time and other cities may be facing serious issues, Detroit is in a pretty good spot and can definitely sustain life, as we've seen, and has access to natural resources. So it has the infrastructure that's built up and obviously needs to be maintained better, but it's there, and it also can support over time and can be built up again in ways that other cities just can't. So its long-term future, I believe, is very bright.
I want to get a little bit more into this idea of how it can sustain life. So looking at the context of this mega region and in the U.S. for that matter, Detroit is also significant because of climate change predictions, particularly concerning sea levels. So for cities like New York and Miami, they're going to have to build expensive seawalls or they're going to go under.
Right.
But that's not the case in Detroit?
The idea of global warming and climate change as it affects coastal cities is being and has been pretty well looked at, and there's these really scary and interesting projections about coastal cities, and in fact, large sections, including much of Florida, for example, where sea level rise over the next decades and 100 years and beyond will really be a significant factor in how those cities are able to operate. Those cities, like New York and Boston and Baltimore and Philadelphia and Miami, New Orleans, they're all right at sea level or just a few feet above. Detroit and Michigan are 600 feet above sea level. So that's really a game changer potentially in terms of how Detroit will not have to deal with that aspect of global warming and climate change.
Another major factor or prediction regarding climate change in the future is this idea of water scarcity. And I think some places out west and then down south are already seeing this. But once again, we're on the Great Lakes Basin. I guess just reiterate why that's such an asset for the city and will continue to be in the future.
As I was writing this article, which is titled Detroit may be bankrupt, but it's 600 feet above sea level. one of the things I looked at was potentially an even scarier notion, that because of climate change and because of how perilous so many populations are in terms of being susceptible to these extreme or more extreme weather patterns that we're predicting will be even more the case over time because of climate change, and how that affects people's access to fresh water. For example, there have been significant drought conditions over, big swaths of the country and in other parts of the world. What will be the effects of climate change on the Great Lakes? We're not entirely sure, but we know that we're sitting on 20% of the world's fresh water supply, which is just a mind-boggling statistic. And as aquifers run out of, water sources underground, and as the Colorado has been suffering because of drought, we as the Detroit region and within the context of the mega region have access to one of these very, very, important elemental pieces of how society, can sustain itself, and that is the Great Lakes watershed.
In your piece, and as you've stated in this interview, you say that Detroit is one of the better investments to sustain life. And I think if you told some people that, they would laugh and be like, what are you talking about? I guess, how do you go about trying to share that message and kind of change that viewpoint?
As a human life goes, it's a long time, maybe we think, but in terms of a society or a city or civilization, our experience is fairly limited. And if you look back and project out, the things that allow people to live and flourish are around us here. We have fertile land. We have access to fresh, clean drinking water. And, as the cost of keeping ways of life may be going up, as we're thinking they may be in other places, these basic elements that many people take for granted are here, and it's not as if we don't have our share of issues. And a lot of them have been created by us. The current state of the city and the region in terms of its finances, in terms of these longstanding issues around race and class and equity and how the manufacturing industry has had an effect, an impact, and much of it positive, much of it negative. We're dealing with a lot of these things, but if you look at these sort of basic building blocks, we have a lot going for us, especially if you compare it to other places around the planet.
I guess when you think about it, it's kind of ironic that Detroit, which made the car, which a lot of people would contribute some of the environmental problems
sure.
going on, is going to be the best situated environmentally in the future. I guess, what are your thoughts on that?
If you think about, not only Detroit, but Detroit is sort of the poster child. There's, certainly other places, and some of these places are, I think, further along But dealing with some of this, a lot of the projects that have happened in Pittsburgh and, you know, how their new arena is fully LEED certified, I haven't heard anything about that for our new arena. But the basic idea that Detroit and places like Detroit were the font of industry and the kind of the place where a lot of, you know, what many would argue are the reason for climate change, the manufacturing industry and automobiles and sprawl, a lot of that stuff started here. So I think there's this really interesting opportunity because of how well Detroit's positioned in terms of its, you know, its ecosystem and its position on the map, to really have not only opportunity but really also the responsibility to help show the world how sustainable communities can be redeveloped and how, you know, we can now look at a longer view and say, well, how are we going to, you know, have a place where millions of people live, and how are we going to treat our vacant lots, and how can we grow food and include more sustainable building practices and include things like wind farms and solar panels and marry the best of technologies with the best of ideas around sustainability so that we can, you know, hopefully begin to address some of the things that we may have done in the past. It's an interesting position Detroit finds itself in.
Francis Grunow is a partner at New Solutions Group, a public policy consulting firm. He also writes for the online publication Model D. Francis, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity.
You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. One of the newest gadgets that is both fascinating and disturbing to people is the Google Glass. You wear it on your face like a pair of glasses. You're able to get information, take pictures, all kinds of things, mostly through voice and touch commands. And Google has asked some people to become explorers to get feedback on the product. We found one right here in Lansing. Us news folk know him as the GOP House Press Secretary by day, Ari Adler. He is also, however, a Google Glass explorer. And today he's joining us to talk about the glass. Hey there.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
The first question, of course, that any radio person who freaks out in the presence of a camera has to ask is, are you taking video on that thing?
I am not taking video. And that has been one of the misconceptions, is that people seem to think that we're continually streaming video from these everywhere we go. And I tend to joke with people and say, most people just aren't that interesting, that I'm going to film them all the time.
Well, this is a relief to me, actually. There's a reason I went into radio. But so you are a second round Google Glass Explorer. What does that mean?
It is the second round where they expanded the invitations to more people to be able to purchase the devices and start exploring with them. They are very much a beta product. So Google is famous for taking things, putting them out in the wild and seeing how they work. Improving on them because of that. And I think it's a great way to do it. And so what we are doing as explorers is we are trying to use them in everyday life and tell Google what our experience is and share them with each other so we can learn tips and tricks. We can work our way through problems and improve it for everyone else later.
How did you decide to become an explorer, and how long have you been doing this for?
I heard about Google Glass when it was first announced, and I actually put in to be in the first round and didn't make the cut because I didn't have a good enough idea in terms of what I was going to use it for. But then the second round opened up, and we happened to have Google come to the Michigan Capitol and show the device off to legislators and others to get an idea of what the tech was like. And I was sold at that point, and I put in my application, and I was thrilled that a few weeks later I received the invitation.
So what kind of things does Google want from you as someone who's essentially testing this product?
One of the things that they ask is that you are willing to really use it everywhere, as you are at work, at home, at play, whatever. They want to have it tested in a lot of different environments. And so what I'm finding in the Google Glass community is that we're sharing experiences, and it's very different depending on where we're at in the country. Those folks of us here in Michigan in the Midwest have been experiencing, well, what happens if it's out in the cold for a long amount of time? You know, does it fog up when you come back inside? How does the battery life last in cold weather versus warm weather? So that's the kind of thing that they're looking for, is that kind of feedback. And how we're using it, any roadblocks we're stumbling upon, and things that they could do to fix it. And they've been very responsive so far. They put out, every month or two, they put out a software update and have been addressing a number of concerns and wish list items that explorers have had.
Well, given that it's about to get cold midweek, how has it been doing in the cold?
It actually has been doing very well. Battery life in general is one of its problems right now, I think. If mm-hmm. I had to point to anything, it needs to be recharged frequently if you use it a lot, particularly for video or for a camera. But it's great to have a camera and have a hands-free device that you can do things with while you're outside in the cold and you keep your hands in your gloves. I've done it a number of times. Yesterday, my wife, Jessie, did the polar plunge for Special Olympics, and I was taking pictures and shooting video, and I was nice and warm while she was jumping into the freezing water.
Good deal. You were just explaining to me before we went on that there are some head movements as well that you can activate things with.
Yeah, the whole thing is operated by one of the temples. Is essentially a touchpad, if you think of it like that, on your computer. So you can tap and swipe and do things. But you can also do a lot of hands-free actions if you have it set up so that I have mine set up so if I look up at a certain angle, it will wake up the device, and then I can give it a verbal command.
So it's essentially, it's almost like shaking a mouse to get your computer to your desktop to wake up.
That's the idea, right, because Google has it set up so that the screen goes off very quickly. Again, they're trying to maintain that battery life for as long as possible.
There are a lot of things it can do, too many probably to list here, but what do you find yourself doing with it the most and using the most?
There are a lot of things it can do. The easiest way to think about it is if you imagine your smartphone, the screen of your smartphone and its capabilities as a heads-up display that you're wearing on your face and above your eyes. So two of the things that I have used a lot with it, I think, would be the ability to text message verbally. I can get a text message on my phone and never have to take it out of my pocket. It shows up on the screen. I can read it. I can then reply to it by voice, and I'm done. And it's much less distracting than having to look at a phone all the time. And the other thing where I've used it, where I think it's tremendously helpful, is you can do turn-by-turn navigation. So using Google Maps, just like you would on a phone or on a GPS unit, I can drive around and get directions, and it is not distracting at all because it is a heads-up display. It turns on when you have a turn approaching, and then it goes back to sleep. You can actually turn the screen off if you want and have it just give you verbal directions if you want to do that. And I've used a cell phone and maps and GPS units and built-in units. Google Glass by far has been the least distracting as a driver.
Interesting. I would have thought maybe that it would have just somehow having that visual pop-up would have been more distracting, but the movement, I suppose, is really, or the lack thereof, must be really helpful.
Well, it allows you to look at directions or a map or a turn that's coming up without having to take your eyes off the road. You're looking out the windshield the entire time, and you can either glance up, or if you need to, you could tip your head down a little bit and literally look through the lens, and you can see right through it.
I know some people experience computer screen eye strain, some more than others. Do you find your eyes feeling different at the end of the day from using this?
I have not. I did the first few days, and Google warns you about that. It's similar if you get a new pair of glasses with a different prescription, and it takes a few days for your eyes to adjust because you're doing a near and far at the same time a lot of times. I have had no problems after that. There have been some reports of people getting headaches from it, and I think that's just everybody's a little different, so you're going to have that experience.
Well, another thing I wondered about, I've noticed that, those of us who got our glasses in the sixth grade, we're used to having this thing on our face, but people who came to glasses later in their life, reading glasses or that kind of thing, can find them really irritating. It just like, they leave them places, they come off their face. Are you feeling fairly comfortable with these, or are you real aware that there's something on your face that hasn't been there?
Well, I've worn glasses for years. I wear contact lenses now. So it was interesting to have to go back to putting a frame on regularly. Mm-hmm. But I think that helped me because putting it on was just similar to putting on a pair of glasses. And you get, after a while, you wear glasses and you get used to that bar being there, and
right,
you don't realize it anymore. I don't find them distracting anymore at all. I forget they're there at times. And the more I spend time with people, like at work, for example, I think they're getting more used to it too. Initially, and I still do at times, I will take them off if I'm in a meeting so people don't think that I'm doing something else on the side while I'm supposed to be listening in the meeting. But also I took it off because I found people staring a little bit and they would be distracted by it. I didn't think mm-hmm. that was appropriate, so they come off.
Well, I can imagine that because, with all of the, people being concerned about their employment and their privacy and that kind of thing. I mean, does the waiter in the restaurant treat you differently? Does the attendant at your doctor's office treat you differently? And what are some of the social things that you've seen from people around this?
I have generally had very positive reactions. Either people aren't really sure what it is, and I tell them what it is, and they're very excited to learn more about it, or some people do know what it is, but haven't seen one yet. And so it's very interesting to get their reactions. And, you know, sometimes if I have the time and I'm trying to explain something to somebody, I've let people try it. And a lot of the Google Explorers will do that. If we have the opportunity, we'll let you try them on. We'll let you see what it does. And a lot of our job, I think, is being an ambassador to and informing people about what it is. There's a lot of concerns about privacy and the pictures being taken and that sort of thing. But I really don't think it's any different than the cell phones we carry in our pocket that can do all of these things already.
Right. Geordie LaForge or Borg jokes for the geekiest amongst us.
Those are pretty constant, yeah. Or there's actually if you're a Star Trek Deep Space Nine fan, there was the Dominion, and they had the devices that they wore to be able to pilot their ship. So yes, being a Star Trek geek, I'm happy with that reference. I think it's great.
There's also questions of other people perceiving rudeness, and there is a term which I guess I probably won't say on the radio for people who are rude while using Google Glass, because sometimes you're talking to the glasses. They don't know, are you putting your order in? Are you talking to them? Are you talking to yourself? You know, should we be worried because you're talking to yourself? I mean, that kind of thing. What's kind of your code of conduct with that?
Well, that word that we won't say on the radio has become popular, I think, because it was so easy to create. And there something that's simple to do with people who have mobile phones, although there's probably comparable people. And it's very similar. The Glass Connect is a Bluetooth device, so I can use it to take and receive phone calls. And so there are times that I'm going to be talking to folks, but it would just be like if you had a Bluetooth device on, and people wonder sometimes if you're talking to yourself or if you're talking to them or, you know, someone on the phone. My wife, Jessie, got asked about how she feels about me wearing them all the time and using them, and her comment was that I do seem to talk to myself more than I used to. So it's interesting, though, because it's not just on the phone, but you're trying to make verbal commands when you're doing things. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, as you probably tell, my voice is a little weak because I'm fighting a cold, and I was nursing my voice all weekend and trying not to use it. And so I discovered two things. One, my family is very bad at charades. And two is that when you have a device that is driven by verbal commands, if you lose your voice, that does pose a bit of a problem.
Oh, okay. And potentially be interesting to see what someone with a real quiet voice would do.
Yeah, and the microphone is very good about picking up verbal commands. If you say what you want to say in a text message or a reply to an email, it does a very good job with voice recognition and being able to pick up what you're saying. I've used it in some loud environments. We went to the auto show earlier this year, and I used it a lot. I was taking pictures. I could then send those pictures to my daughter, and I could attach a caption to it, and I did it all verbally, and it picked up everything I was saying with no problem.
As you get more used to them, and I guess this would be my fear, is that if I had a device like this and I started to get more used to it, I would be worried that I would get so used to it that I would inadvertently transmit, you know, myself scooping the cat box or, you know, something worse than that. Have you found yourself having some Google gaffes?
Not really. There's a couple of steps involved in order to take a picture, for example, and then send it or share it publicly anywhere. So that hasn't been a problem. There is a button on it as well. You can take a picture a number of ways. There's a verbal command, or you can also push a button on it to start a video or to take a picture. And occasionally, because of its location on the top of the temple, if you set the glass down just right, I've had a number of upside-down pictures taken on my desk, but you know, they don't go anywhere unless you send them.
It's like how you always take pictures of your knees with your smartphone. Yeah. What are other people in the Google Explorer community doing with theirs? Because as you said, it's a different group of people geographically and in terms of what they do for a living. What are some of the innovative things you're seeing the people are using this for?
It is a very diverse group. And that one of the exciting things about being in this program is seeing what people are coming up with. And then you'll see something and you'll think, why didn't I think of that? Why, you know, this is a great opportunity. So we have everything from physicians who are using it and surgeons who are using it in surgery to show students what they're doing as they're doing the surgery. We have a firefighter who's an explorer who is on an app for the glass that essentially firefighters would arrive at a scene and maybe a map would pop up and they'd see where all the hydrants are. Or they could be in a building and pull up a schematic of the floor that they're on. Just tremendous life-saving possibilities for that. Other things that are a little more mundane or routine, there's an auto dealer that has one, and he's working on a plan where, say, you take your car in for repairs and the mechanic figures out what's wrong with it. They could call you and do a video call with you through glass and literally walk through what's going on in your car and show you the parts they need to replace. And that would be tremendously helpful.
So what's next? Now that, you know, this isn't the, you're part of the testing phase, do you see yourself hanging on to this gadget or saying, hey, it was a good run, I enjoyed being an explorer, and now I'm all done?
Well, I purchased the device, as explorers have to do, so it's mine to stay with, and I have really enjoyed it. The more I use it, the more I use it. I become more comfortable with it and find more uses for it. They're talking about consumer release sometime at the end of 2014 or by the end of 14. We'll see if that works. They have some work to do, I think, before they can get enough people interested in it, before they can bring the price down for folks to make it, you know, acceptable to the masses, I suppose. But it's got tremendous potential, and I think that's really going to change the way we see the world.
Ari Adler is the Michigan House GOP press secretary and also a second round Google Glass Explorer. And thank you for coming out despite your cold today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Well, if there's one thing we can find pretty much universal bipartisan agreement on is that it has been a nasty winter this year. And you might find some relief from the icy grip of winter at the Wharton Center tonight. One of Europe's finest orchestras presents the fiery music of two of its great native sons. And Peter Worf is here with more on tonight's Wharton Center performance. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Melissa. Yes, from the icy depths of Mother Russia comes the St. Petersburg Philharmonic. They're playing Rachmaninoff and Prokofiev tonight at the Wharton Center for Performing Arts. They'll be joined by violin soloist Vilde Frang from Norway. The St. Petersburg Philharmonic has, in the last week or so, performed in Ann Arbor and in Chicago and now in East Lansing. And I talked to the soloist, violinist Vilde Frang, by phone at her Berlin home just a few days ago about recent recordings, tonight's program, and her early musical life.
It was so obvious just immediately when I picked up the violin that my life was simply, you know, it was going to be channeled somehow through the instrument. The instrument is kind of a tool for living for me, actually. So I thought I was going to play the double bass, though, because both my father and my sister, they play, they're both double bassists. But my father actually avoided that, and he made me a tiny violin himself.
Let's go fast forward to your recent recording of a couple of the great peaks of the violin mountain range, the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto and the Nielsen Violin Concerto.
Yeah, I think it was a very rewarding experience for me, actually, because I had the chance of combining a very familiar violin concerto, which is kind of a milestone in the repertory, with another more exotic, less sort of hackneyed piece. Tchaikovsky was one of my earliest acquaintances. After I started playing the violin, I think I heard it when I was 5 or something, and it made a terrific impression on me.
Let's talk about then two other concertos that are very different but written by the same composer. One of them you'll perform here in Michigan with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic. It's Prokofiev's second violin concerto. Mm-hmm. You've also recorded his first violin concerto, and they're very, very different pieces from different times in life, very different styles. The first being almost like, I've heard it described as almost a fairy tale, very impressionistic. And then the piece that you'll be bringing is in some ways much more classical in form, in the three movements with a big first movement, a very lyrical, a song-like cantabile second movement, and then an almost dance-like third movement. You'll play that second concerto. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say actually the first concerto is very lyrical. That is, that really shows the very sort of transparent side of Prokofiev. The second concerto is more, I think, if you have never heard Prokofiev before, that's a perfect piece to start with, actually, because it is a tourist trap for Prokofiev lovers. I think it's really like a tourist-friendly Prokofiev, in a way, because it is so typical him, and it has so many spontaneous, you know, things happening in the first moment, so many different characters just appearing out of the blue, really, and it's one of the most beautiful second movements there is in the violin repertory, in my opinion. And then we have this kind of burlesque third movement, which is quite rough and with a lot of vodka and, you know, this kind of it's music that really sort of wears its heart on the sleeve.
Let's talk about two other great masterpieces that you're associated with. And if I have this information correct, you've played both a Stradivarius violin and a Viome. Which will you be bringing to Michigan, or is it a different instrument?
Yes. Actually, I had a Viome violin, which I bought from the Anders Viomutter Foundation, in which I was a scholarship holder for many years. And when I left the foundation, I was able to buy this wonderful instrument that I've been playing for the last 8 years, I think. And then I did a tour with Esa-Pekka Salonen and the London Philharmonia last year. And during the tour, Maestro Salonen just asked me in the beginning what instrument I was playing. And I loved my Viom very much, and I didn't want to change. But in his opinion, a Strad would be the perfect choice. And actually, at the end of the tour, he did inform me that he had found me this instrument from the Nippon Foundation, and that is basically how I got it. I'm only playing the Strad now because I don't like playing two different instruments at once. I think that is it would feel wrong. It's a luxury. It would be a luxury that you don't really need. If you're an artist, you have to concentrate on one instrument in order to create a universe.
Do you remember how you thought or what you felt when you first picked up this instrument and started playing it?
Obviously, the first thing you notice with a Strad is its potential and its volume. You know, how easy everything is. And then you realize how much you have actually worked on your previous instruments and how much you have fighted and how much sweat and tears it takes to achieve what you really want. And I think that is not necessarily a bad thing for a musician.
I loved what you said about the Prokofiev concerto earlier, that it was sort of a tourist trap for Prokofiev. What do you hope that listeners will discover about Prokofiev after hearing your performance of the second violin concerto?
Oh, I really hope that whatever I'm performing, really, I really hope that the performance itself gives the listener a possibility to make up entirely his or her own interpretation of the piece. That is ideally what I would like to achieve when I'm playing.
violinist Vilde Frang performs with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic Monday night at the Wharton Center at Michigan State University. Vilde, thanks so much for the time and the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Along with gambling, big production stage shows like Wayne Newton and that kind of thing, Las Vegas is also well known for fine dining. Everywhere you look, you'll find a restaurant with a different theme, many of them run by celebrity chefs. Travelers from Michigan, though, might want to consider a more humble spot to grab a bite in Vegas. Current State's Scott Pohl recently spent some time there, and he's here with a look at what you might consider to be some comfort food from home amidst the glitz and glamour of Sin City. How's it going, Scott?
Hi, it's good. Good. Nice to be here today. There's a downtown Detroit dining institution called American Coney Island. They've been selling their signature chili dogs on West Lafayette Boulevard for almost a century. It's a family-owned business that, after all these years, has opened a few additional locations, and the newest one is in The D, which is a casino on the famous Fremont Street in downtown Las Vegas. On the day I stopped by, I ran into owner Chris Sotteropoulos. He grew up in Okemos.
We had a customer of ours, Derek and Greg Stevens, two brothers, came in one day and told us, hey, we're have a casino in Las Vegas. This is our idea. We're naming it The D, and we want you guys in here. You know, longtime customers. Their grandfather brought their father. Their father brought them. Now they bring their kids. And they came to us, talked to us, flew us out, and, you know, it was a good fit. You know, it was a family working with family, which was a key for us.
I think some listeners may not be aware of the fact that it's called The D because the ownership is based in Detroit, and that's sort of a theme here that Detroit as much as possible in Las Vegas. Is that right?
Yeah, it's very much true. Derek, you know, and his brother Greg are very big, you know, fans of Michigan and Detroit, and, you know, named The D for a few reasons. You know, Derek, you know, The D, downtown, and, you know, Detroit as well, you know, has a real Detroit feel here.
So when did the hot dog shop open here in the casino?
We've been here about a year and some change, and things have been great.
How would you compare it to the way sales are, say, at your Detroit location?
Well, you know, Detroit location is Detroit. It's great. You know, it's always does well. But, yeah, Vegas is very comparable right up there. So it does real well.
So you don't live here in Vegas. Tell me how the operation works since you're still based in Michigan.
Well, it's, you know, we have Joey Sobosinski, who's our general manager here. He used to work for us in Detroit for many years and one of our head guys. He moved out here to take over full operations. And by between myself and my sister Grace, who's my business partner, we go back and forth. And, you know, it makes a nice little getaway sometimes, especially when Michigan's how it is right now with the snow and cold.
I was going to ask you about this location. You're kind of tucked into a spot here in the D. I would like to assume that you have people who make a point of coming here because it's the D and because they know that you're here selling the Coney dogs that people are familiar with from being in Detroit. Do you get some of that kind of business through here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's great. You know, a lot of people don't realize, but here in Las Vegas, there's a lot of Michiganders that have moved here and lived here and been here for years and, you know, excited to see that we're here and come find us. And, you know, being right here on the world-famous Fremont Street and having Fremont Street exposure and the entrance right there, it's been great. We get phone calls all the time, you know, and people coming in saying, I haven't had a Coney dog since I was a little kid, since we moved out, you know, 18 years ago, and it's been great. So we have a good following.
Am I correct this is your first location other than the Detroit location?
Well, it's the first location outside of Michigan. We also, you know, downtown Detroit's been there for 97 years, since 1917, since, you know, our grandfather invented the name American Coney Island and the Coney dog. And we also have a location in Ford Field where the Detroit Lions are. We just wrapped up our second year. The Detroit Zoo, where we are celebrating our third year there. And we also opened up another location in Canton. But this is our first location outside of Michigan.
Are you thinking about further expansion?
You know, we've been approached by a lot of people for franchising or, you know, even a lot of different amusement parks, even a big one, the West Coast. And we've contemplated, we thought, but, you know, we're not looking to franchise and have one on every corner and all this stuff. that's one of the main things I did prior for jumping in the family business. I was in the franchise business, and that's one thing we don't want to do with our brand, you know. It's we're happy where we're at, and it has to be a real special location for us to kind of move out, like here in Las Vegas.
Tell me the basics of your Coney dog.
Well, like anything else, it's been the same since 1917. You know, a steam bun, a natural casing, Dearborn sausage hot dog, our world-famous chili, a Belgian mustard with a sweet onion.
Is the menu here different in any way from Detroit?
The only really difference is that we actually don't serve the full menu that we have. Because of everything, kind of space-wise and everything, we have our Coney's, our loose burgers, obviously our fries, or chili fries and chili cheese fries, and also our gyro, that, you know, the Cone's gyros that we shave right off, and the tzatziki sauce, which is our grandmother's famous recipe that we make in-house every day. So it's a more limited menu than compared to full one.
Well, it's kind of nice as a Michigander to have a little piece of home when you're in Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah, it's great. You know, it's funny. We get people that come in all the time, like, hey, we just left Detroit, had you on Friday in Detroit, and hey, we're here Saturday. So it's good. It's comforting, you know. It's always a good comforting when you're out of town and you can find something you realize you see and makes you feel good.
Chris Satchiropoulos is owner of American Coney Island Chili Dogs in Detroit and other locations in the Detroit area, and now on the famous Fremont Street in Las Vegas. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you and having you here, visiting us here in Las Vegas.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Emmanuel Berry will be sitting in for Mark Bayshore, and we'll update Michigan's same-sex marriage trial. Also, Gray Wilson joins us for Great Lakes Month in Review. That and more tomorrow on Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is producer extraordinaire, thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also, Aaron Young for engineering and Kelsey Block for production assistance. I'm Melissa Benmark. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.